Hey guys, welcome to the Decentralized Podcast. We're here with Colin and Colin from Nexus. I'm actually going to give it over to Colin to open it up. But Colin Cantrell, the founder of Nexus.
Hey everybody, thank you for having us on the show. I'm excited to be here. It's really cool to be in the land down under.
Cool, great to have you.
Getting some things moving, yeah, learning, meeting a lot of the community here. So thank
you
for having us. Yeah, first time here.
First time for both of you? No?
Oh, he's okay. Other Colin's been here for a while.
Okay, other Colin.
Just call him Forbes. That's what I do.
Cool, man. All right, guys. So I think out of today's podcast, we really want to dive deep into, I think there's different layers of Nexus that we want to explore. So number one, not just the technological piece about the 3D blockchain and the better quantum resistance and things like that, but also understanding a little bit more about the governance and how Nexus as a project is being managed around the world. I think that's an interesting place that we can dive into, and then we'll see where the conversation takes us.
Sounds good.
Man, is there any particular point at which you want to start, or you know, should we start maybe with a little bit about your background, how you two, you know, both linked up?
I mean, we can do a little bit of an introduction. I mean, cool. For those of you that don't know me, I've a self-taught programmer, so I've been programming since I was about 10 or 11.
Yep.
Learned by reading other people's code. That brought me into Bitcoin, where back then the only way to find out how to build cryptocurrency was to read the code.
Yep.
And so I worked from Satoshi's original code and started seeing some of the pitfalls and some ways to be improved. And then observing the block size debate and all the scaling issues that were coming out over the few years that Nexus was existing, and developing new architecture like the 3D chain, making sure that we take into account satellite systems and mesh networks so we can build our own hardware to run the software systems on, and getting something that can foresee some of the challenges that we're going to see, like centralized development, mining pools, and a lot of other aspects that Bitcoin and Ethereum and other cryptocurrencies have fallen victim to. So it's learning from other people's mistakes and making sure we don't make them as we grow and get bigger.
Cool. And how did Colin number two get involved?
Colin Forbes. My background is 30 years in corporate finance. I started my career with Ernst & Young as an auditor. Went from there into a myriad of different entities, public corporations, private corporations. I worked as a military contractor in Iraq for 8 years. Actually started a business here in Australia with a mate of mine that I met in Iraq.
Yep.
And Gladstone. Ran that for a couple of years. Big footy fan.
Cool.
My dad's Maori, and so of course go the All Blacks.
Yep.
Just cut the listenership right there, right?
Yeah, I know. It runs like off.
But as far as how I got involved here, I was back in the, I was in the States in 2013, really trying to figure out what I was going to do after I tried my hand at entrepreneurship. And it was in summer of 2016 that I found Bitcoin. And as a longtime student of the world of money and corporations, I had learned that there is a central control over the creation of our money.
Yeah.
The typical creation is debt-based creation of money, fractional reserve lending, and you start to understand those things and you realize there's not really anything you can do about it, and it feels frustrating. You feel trapped. You feel, anyway, I found Bitcoin and I thought, holy cow, this could be the thing, you know?
Yeah.
And so I just immersed myself, because like Colin said, the way he had to learn blockchain coding was to go read Satoshi's code.
Correct.
Early on, if you wanted to learn about blockchain, the only thing I found was YouTube. So I just been consuming YouTube. And October of 16, I happened to stumble across the creature from Satoshi Island, which is the very first interview that Colin ever did. And I didn't understand a damn word he said for the first 20 minutes, because it was all this hairy, intense code. But when he started to talk about why he did it, I mean, it was just one of those moments where you have this sense of knowing, and I just knew I had to get involved. And so I began to accumulate, went into the Slack channel, the community, which at the time was less than 200 people.
Yep.
And everybody was just beautiful. I mean, helpful and supportive. And next thing you know, here I'm in Australia with Colin Cantrell, and I'm the CFO of the Nexus Embassy. It's
brilliant.
It's been a dream.
Brilliant, brilliant. Well, let's. I want to start with one quick question around what you mentioned about diving into the Bitcoin code and seeing some of the flaws. Can you tell me a little bit about what you think are the flaws around it and how you think you've potentially solved some of the flaws with Nexus?
Well, one of the biggest flaws is the fact that it's serialized. It's one message after the other. It's one block after the other, and there's a finite space, and it relies on Moore's law as a scaling solution. If you read the Bitcoin white paper, it states that. But the problem is it blocks as they get bigger and bigger and bigger. They're going to be getting through the wire slower and slower, and then the actual ability to process them takes longer and longer. Right now, on average, if you don't have a solid state drive with Ethereum, for instance, it takes 25 seconds to validate one block.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, people can't utilize it because it's like trying to take a big freight train or a big freight ship to every city in the world, and then, you know, you pick and choose what letter you get out of there if you want, and creating endless copies of that. And also the second part of it is it's a flood network. It has N squared routing, which means it exponentially gets slower and slower the more nodes join the system.
Mm-hmm.
But ironically, you need more nodes in order to have a higher robustness. So you have to have this trade-off between the two. So with the three-dimensional chain, the one thing that I solved is I looked at it from a blockchain's perspective. I didn't go how Hashgraph or Stellar or any of these other ones have gone, where they're just doing over-the-wire messaging and hoping that that brings consensus. You still want to have a cryptographic chaining structure, but you want to inherit it in a way that it can multiply its capacity without relying on a single block size. So the best analogy for the 3D blockchain is it's able to create parallelism in the network, but checks and balances as well, so that there's not one type of validator that controls the entire protocol. And it's like building a block up in real time over different nodes and different shards, and then all of them can agree upon each other. So it happens in real time instead of waiting for all the transactions to be included and then one hash ruling all.
I was about to say it sounds a little bit like sharding as you're explaining it, with the parallelism. Do you not think, though, that the concept of serialization is a feature, not a bug, in the sense that, you know, you've got it limits spam, it creates a marketplace within which people, you know, want to submit transactions and things like that.
Well, spams are limited by the transaction fees. It's not really limited by the serialism. I mean, and if you look at even the net back-end code, the way messages are processed, they're processed one after the other, after the other, after the other. Mm-hmm. There's no parallel processing even on the network layers. So I don't really consider it a feature. I consider Bitcoin, it was actually based off of B-Money and Hashcash, if you read some of the original B-Money architecture. So I don't think it was really designed to be a global system. It was more of an experiment. Mm-hmm. And now that we've seen the experiment, which solved the two generals problem with Byzantine fault tolerance, with the proof of work as being the trusted intermediary to have distributed computing working, I think it was a step in the direction of proving to us what is capable of, just like the vacuum tube showed us how we can create switches and then therefore logic gates. But we're working on the transistor, and that's what's going to really be able to bring it to the world.
Okay. Can you dive in a little bit deeper around this 3D blockchain piece where, you know, understand that there's a concept of parallel computation happening so you can get, you know, more throughput, you know, for the same amount of energy, for the same amount of work, for the same amount of time. So can you talk a little bit more about how that functions?
So think about the sharding, or the aspects of sharding, as having different state channels. Mm-hmm. So depending on the capacity of each state channel, it will establish a new one or remove one depending on how much is needed. So each one of these will operate on their own L1 locks, and there'll be a different type of validation node. And they're going to still have certain levels of Byzantine fault tolerance at about 3L plus 1, because there can still be malicious nodes that could try to create lock conflicts. And that's one of the problems with parallelism, is how do you prevent people from doing lock conflicts and have a truth that's communicated in parallelism?
Yeah.
And that's where you get to the L2 locks, which create the cross links, which are actually linking them, and those are stake weight based. So what those do is they use their weight of stake to verify and prove that they have made sure there's no lock conflicts, and then they also develop trust along there. And then the final one is taking those cross links on the L3 locks and hashing those, and that's where the miners come in. So instead of the miners having the authority of the transaction, what they're doing is they're checking the cross links of the L2s, and they're putting their trust out there and saying, I have this much trust, and I'm putting this much weight into the data right now to ensure that I have verified the L2s, and the L2s have verified the L1s. And if there's any sort of discrepancy from the L1 to the L2 layers, everybody in that chain of custody is going to lose trust. And you solve the nothing at stake problem with that. And then when you tie trust to an economic incentive based around how much nexus you can get per your trust level, you create a massive incentive for people to want to maintain trust and integrity, and then that also develops kind of a long-term track record of people's consistent validation and waiting. And it also makes an attacker required to spend an incredible amount of time to attack the network. So if, let's say, 5 years from now, somebody tries to jump in with 10,000 nodes and try to create 10,000 sig chains and then try to attack the network, they're not going to have the same track record other nodes have with one another, and they're going to have to make up that time that other nodes have on them, but they're never going to be able to get it back because other nodes are developing that time as well.
Okay.
So it's the main thing is the checks and balancing systems and the parallelism with that cross-linking. So that's why it's called multidimensional chain or three-dimensional chain, because you're not chaining it in this direction. You're chaining it in that direction, and then you're chaining it one more time with the miners.
So the miners, so L3 sounds like the miners are doing some form of proof of work.
Yes, sir.
And the L2 sounds like a proof of stake.
Yep.
What's the L1?
L1 is just verifying ECDSA signatures and signing off on the data as a witness to the data. Like I was stating, kind of as a Byzantine fault tolerance. Basically, what Hashgraph is doing is kind of what an L1 will be. Okay. Right, the level of security anyway, or ray blocks, where it's literally just sending a message over the wire, everybody agreeing that they have that message, then that being grouped, and then the weight that they're basically adding is maybe a little bit of a prime number, a little bit of proof of time, and then their trust, and then other nodes agreeing upon that in that state channel, because a node's going to be assigned to a state channel deterministically from their previous signing. So it's going to be difficult for them to assign themselves to a new channel, so they're going to be randomly selected per channel and randomly selected with a certain space to validate. And so then from there, the L2s, then there can be multiple L2 lockers that weight it with more and more stake that then therefore verify that again, make sure there's no lock conflicts, and then again weight it with the L3 and the miners.
Okay, and at this stage, from a release standpoint, Nexus is still at L1, I believe, or is it L1 and L2?
Well, Nexus right now is still a linear blockchain. Okay. So you're familiar probably with the Tau framework, or Tritium, as a lot of people talk. Tritium is the first step of the Tau framework, which is Tritium, Amin, and Obsidian. Now, those are three stages that unlock it. Amin is where you can actually get to the full gridding in the L1, L2. Tritium is setting the base of advanced contracts and signature chains and some of the base level features. And then Obsidian is going to get to the L3 locks, which also are going to function as a distributed mining pool to a certain extent, so that multiple shares and multiple miners can submit to that. And then, of course, after that, we get to the DAC, the Distributed Autonomous Community, which opens up 6 voter groups, and that's how our governance system is going to function. And so one of the principles or the reasons that I'm building it is the Tau framework, is it's 3 hard fork upgrades, but it will allow any regular linear blockchain to upgrade into a 3-dimensional chain or a multidimensional chain, so that other people besides Nexus can still benefit from the architecture and the technology.
Okay. Justin, do you have something?
Run us through how your satellite system works with the mesh network and the uplinks, just so people can understand what that's about.
Yeah, the biggest thing is we're not looking at deploying this entire constellation ourselves and being the rulers of it. What we're building is a model and a template that other people can apply themselves, and open sourcing the satellite technology and also standardizing the communication protocols between other satellite constellations, so that they can all talk to one another. Just like ISPs actually share their hops between one another, it's going to be a similar concept with the satellites, because the only way for it to be a truly distributed satellite mesh network is it needs to be owned by multiple people and not one specific entity. So Vector's Galactic Sky, they're going to have cross-rank capability, and we're most likely going to be able to standardize a link between them so that their constellation can talk to some of our constellation that can talk to other people's constellations, potentially Space Chain or other people that are penetrating the satellite space, so that we can all share that and allow equal access to where if I don't have a satellite over my country, well, I can cross-link to your satellite and then downlink to another person's ground station. And the biggest key to that is the standardized protocols. Just like the Internet Engineering Task Force actually goes and standardizes the protocols on the internet, and they create RFCs, which means requests for comment. That allows all of these things to function. If we didn't have a standard TCP/IP, computers wouldn't be able to talk to one another. So that's the biggest point of it, is to go out there and do what hasn't been done, to figure out all of the ways that people can do it, I guess you can say, and figure out how to decentralize the telemetry, decentralize the operational systems, and also standardize the processes between them, so anybody should theoretically be able to launch their own satellite and continue to build the constellation.
Okay.
Sir, what's someone's incentive to go launch their own satellite?
Well, there's some economic incentives that could be seen in it. You could let's say, potentially make money from other people utilizing it, or you could have this, let's say, the ego of you want to put your own satellite up there, or, I mean, you want to contribute to the constellation. Right now, the full economic incentive tied to, let's say, minting Nexus has not been fully formulated. I'm sure that there's going to be certain aspects of it that are going to be challenging to bring that, but the idea is that you give access because you need access to the satellite constellation, and from giving access up there and your satellite, you can therefore have access to other people's satellites. So it would be kind of a joined group of things in that sense.
So in that sense, would a satellite act a little bit like a node?
That's one idea of it, yeah. Okay. I mean, you don't really want to do the computation on the satellite, though, because you have so much radiation in space and it's going to be very slow. You really want them to be packet forwarders as much as possible, but that's the idea anyway, yes.
How many satellites do you envision would need to be up there?
Hundreds upon thousands. I mean,
work, right?
It depends also on your radio frequencies.
Yep.
I mean, we're looking away from radio frequencies, more into optical frequencies, which is most likely going to be the best way, especially dealing with FCC regulations. They don't own any optical, and that actually gives you incredibly high bandwidth. It's just something that's very favorable and desirable to that. So, yeah.
Okay. And I know that it's like predicting the future, but how far off do you think before something like that starts to become more viable, i.e. you see people launching satellites to help build this mesh network? Do you think that's like a couple years? Do you think that's a 10-year thing, 15, 20?
I think it's a lot sooner than we may think. I'd say 2 to 5 years, especially once the model gets very, very simplified and it's easy for people to go up there, and then especially developing more economic incentives on the ground stations or on the satellites. Yes, I see it being viable within the next 5 years, definitely.
Okay. So, and the purpose, again, just to reiterate for the listeners, of putting those satellites up there is to create almost a, I mean, it's a censorship resistance strategy, right?
Yes.
Effectively, yeah.
Yeah, and it's also distributing the power structures of the internet. Right now, it's controlled by just a few entities, a few major companies around the world. And I mean, they own the cables. If you look at the cost of a cable from Europe to the US, it's $300 million. It's an incredible amount of money that's actually put into the infrastructure of the internet, let alone as you continually have to run more and more cable, it depletes resources and it becomes increasingly more expensive. So it's breaking up those different telecommunication companies into smaller pieces so that it can be more individually owned and, yes, therefore more censorship resistant.
Will that satellite mesh network almost act as a replacement, or is the idea for it to be like another internet?
It'll most likely, at least in its inception, be still connected to the old internet. Okay. So I would consider it an extension, an alternative to it. And that's where the location identity separation protocol, or otherwise known as LISP, comes in very handy, since your endpoint identifier is actually its own static number, which you can have as an IP6 address or a Nexus trust key or whatever. The routing locators shift under it, which means I can go as a routing locator directly to your phone on a Wi-Fi ad hoc network, or I can contact a satellite if there's one above. So people will still be able to access me as me in my endpoint identifier, but it'll be able to roam between many different networks, including LTE satellites. So the idea is that when you have the satellite, that is a preferable choice, but when you don't, you'll still have to use some of the conventional wires that we already have.
Okay. And is the idea to move away from some of those conventional infrastructure and to
That's the idea, yes.
Okay, cool.
And to build a model of how do we make a distributed internet ourselves, and how is that going to look, and then how can other people contribute to building it? Because that's what is going to make it something incredibly robust, just like nodes on the network.
Yeah.
Anybody can fire one up, and then they service the network, and if one node goes down, it doesn't bring the internet down.
Correct.
The same type of concept, but on hardware.
Now, so is the long-term vision then for this satellite mesh network not to be just for processing Nexus transactions, but to be for a broader set of
users? For routing all different types of communication data, yes.
So in other words, a new age Facebook could potentially run on something like that?
Yeah, on the mesh networks on the ground too, so as above, so below.
Yep.
You want to do the least amount possible on the satellites. You want to use them for line of sight to be able to do intercontinental relays.
Yep.
But even if you get, let's say, a high density of ground-based mesh networks, think about all of the traffic that exists on highways. Those could become wireless circuits. It can route between different cities. Localized calls or localized communications can be done through the city itself. if you need to make connections to other countries or continents, then you'd want to pounce off of the satellites, but you'd want to do a lot of it on the ground as well. And that's another part of it, is bringing together all of these different mesh networks that are already forming around the world and saying we can help connect you together with these satellite systems, and we can help build this model for you to be able to have more capability in your systems.
Okay. Who doesn't like this idea?
It depends on them, the perspective of each individual. Who would not like
to see it succeed, though?
I'd say ISPs, definitely. Yeah. Possibly other people that are trying to create low Earth orbit ISPs, like OneWeb SpaceX.
Mm-hmm.
OneWeb's already had some pushback with Vector a little bit. They're feeling a little threatened. I mean, I think pretty much the old ways, the old systems that don't want to change.
Yeah.
They want to just continually retain their monopoly on the world. Those are the ones that are most likely going to not want to see it succeed.
And what's their advantage over what Nexus has?
Money,
yep.
Power,
okay.
Influence.
Yep. Now, how does that impede the pathway to creating this whole censorship, you know, resistant mesh network? Like, you know, what happens when you want to get these other people to launch satellites to help connect with the mesh network that Nexus wants to create, which is free, global, et cetera, but they have more of an incentive to build a solution for OneWeb or something like that? How do you overcome that piece?
I'm not entirely sure because I haven't gotten to that. Plus, I haven't seen all of the obstacles that have come up. I know the biggest one that they do is the actual communication frequencies. That's the biggest trouble right now.
Yeah.
You usually have to go to the licensing organization in each individual country or deal with the ITU, which is the International Telecommunication Union, which they actually have very, very tight hold on each one of these frequency ranges. So we figure optics is something that's going to totally bypass that, especially getting experimental frequencies. Optics are going to be the new gold rush. So, I mean, how will they impede? I'm not entirely sure. What would give somebody a motivation to work with them versus us? I would say principle is something that we have that they don't.
Yep.
And I see that the world's moving into a new type of thinking that I think is not going to be as complementary to their way of thinking. So if it's just a monetary base or greed or anything like that, I mean, there's generally probably going to have other people try to pool in with these other big organizations. But if people that are about the principle and they're about doing something that's better for the world or improving it, I think that's going to be a drive that they can never have because they're generally not as authentic as the people that need to use them because they've let the power or the money get to their head and not really seen the capability of people. They see people as numbers. They don't see people as people.
Yeah. Arguably, though, I think, and I think Facebook was a good example of this, is there was this whole uproar around Cambridge Analytica and people saying, oh, you know, our privacy got taken and shit.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you turn around to the average person and say, all right, well, guess what? Now you can't use Messenger anymore. You have to pay for it. They'd be like, well, fuck that. I'll give all my privacy away. Like,
exactly.
I think the general public, what they're more interested in is a result. So, and I guess I'm just playing devil's advocate here.
Go for it.
With all due respect, is that I think there needs to be a strategy. And I know you must be under the pump with 50 million other things anyway. But I think there needs to be a strategy around, you know, how do you combat creating that? Because the thing about a network is that it needs a network effect in order to be useful, right? There's no point in building a network when there's not enough nodes in the network to make it effective.
Exactly.
So if you've got someone that's operating on what you're calling the old style, you know, I guess capitalist greed sort of framework, but they deliver a solution that gives people access to the internet for free and all that sort of shit, because they've got the capital and the go-to-markets and the strategy to be able to implement that before Nexus does, you know, I mean, I'm just looking at it as that's a risk to...
Well, it's always a risk, but, I mean, they're always going to be spiders, and we're always a starfish. So,
yeah.
I mean, what that means is that they're always going to be limited to their movements. There's always a head to what they're doing. What we're building is kind of a guerrilla situation where anybody can do it. So it wouldn't necessarily always be that it has to be this global thing that everybody uses, but as long as people continue to build that network, it will fit in between the cracks, and it won't matter if they have a constellation. People have asked me, well, what if they beat you to it? What if they try to obstruct? Then that's what they do. They're going to have another constellation up there. It's not going to really change anything of what we're doing because there's plenty of space to do it. We're just filling in that space for the people that are inclined to do that.
Okay. All right. Let's go back to, unless you've got something pressing, Justin, around that? Okay. I wanted to go back to the 3D blockchain
cool.
Piece. So, I mean, your explanation really helped me in terms of understanding. So that first layer being more like a, I mean, I'm guessing it's not a directed acyclical graph, but it's kind of in that vein, right? It's kind of in
the directed acrylic graph.
Yeah.
Not necessarily. Not, no. Directed acrylic graph is where you basically have the previous two transactions that you verify and wait whenever you have to send out a new transaction.
Mm. I mean, isn't that what Hashgraph is sort of?
Hashgraph is, from what I understand of it, from just my limited studies of it, they're using a gossip about gossips.
Yeah.
The gossip protocol is basically stating events that have happened, and then they're synchronizing it to a logical clock. They have to have some sort of synchronized clock between all of them in order to know what event happened before what event, in case there's a lock race that happens between two conflicting transactions. And the big problem with that is the time on all computers is not always synchronized. They actually see seconds differently, so to do it in a truly distributed, decentralized way is going to be very, very challenging. So most likely what they're going to rely on is centralized validators, which all of those types of messaging systems do. Even directed acrylic graphs, such as IOTA, uses coordinator nodes, as they call them, which are centrally run nodes that basically are the authority over the information on the transactional data to prevent those lock conflicts from happening. RayBlox uses multiple levels of voting with stake in order to make that possible to resolve lock conflicts, but it still opens up problems. So I definitely don't really consider it to be like that, and okay. I see that being the other end of the scale on scaling solutions, where it's we can have this protocol message that's broadcasted and then nodes that generally have an authority over that rather than having a truly distributed system like it was meant to be.
Okay. I'm trying to figure out a way to, I guess, help the user or help the listener here that maybe is not as technically adept kind of understand it at a more building blocks level. Do you have the two-year-old, I guess, version of that? Because I know, I mean, I've been around the space for ages, and even I'm like...
I work
struggling
on
to grasp.
Colin's usually a good translator. Do you want to take a stab at it? No?
Okay.
I usually say it's like a mail truck. So when you send your transaction out, you're sending out a letter, and then that letter gets taken and verified and put into a box, and then the box gets put into a mail truck, and then it gets shipped to the city of its destination, and then it's get unpacked, and you got your transaction. That's like the different levels of locks. And L1 is basically, well, here's my transactions, they're put into a box. And then the L2s is like the transporter that transports it to the city of its destination in those boxes. And then the L3s is kind of like the global, hey, this has happened, I know this has happened, I've witnessed all these mail trucks going to these places, and I've verified that they've gone to each one of these places. So it's kind of like stepping up or building it in real time, little piece by little piece, instead of having to take this big chunk of data and throw it through the wire, like generally happens now with a block. It's kind of like having very small pieces or very small little blocks being built in real time, but then there's security added as time goes forward, instead of it being kind of like a digital 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 little clicks like it is with a blockchain. It'll be more analog. It'll be a scalar value so that a merchant will be able to choose a number to say, well, I know this number 3 is fairly secure because I've had this many people potentially attack me and have double spending, because you have a series of probabilities, I guess you can state. So with a blockchain, the more confirmations you have, the higher or the lower the probability that you can have that transaction
reversed,
put back in and reversed.
Yeah.
Exactly. So the same type of thing, but this just makes it a very smooth transition instead of a 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 over a period of time. And it accounts for all of the nodes being able to see that transaction and all of them to see that data and all of them to agree upon that data and check and balance one another, so that I guess it's like little piece by little piece building up a block in real time.
And when you say nodes here, do you mean the L2s or the L3s?
All three,
okay.
L1, L2, or L3.
Okay.
Do the so effectively you've got three chains, is that correct?
Not three chains, no, they're three locking levels. So
Okay.
think about it. Think about like the L1s as being kind of like parallel blockchains. Let's just call it that, right? And then what you need to do is you need to make sure that there's no conflicts between, let's say, somebody over here tries to spend something they don't have, you know, or somebody over here is trying to do the same or trying to play the credits. The L2s come along, and then they tie those blockchains together horizontally. So think of it like making a grid, right? And then they go through and they lock certain pieces of that and they say, okay, well, we've checked consistency across all of these different individual chains, made sure there's no lock conflicts, and now we're weighting it with our stake and chaining each one of these specific chains together. And that creates kind of the cross-link grid. And
when
then
you say they're chaining it, so is there an actual cryptographic hash there?
Yes.
On that section?
They're gonna take the exact cryptographic hash or a section of those hashes that they verified and then hash that to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next to get to a final hash,
okay,
which is going to be representing the crosslink.
And is there a time interval between each of those crosslinks?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Cool.
The crosslinks will most likely happen 15 to 20 seconds, but those will be environmental parameters you can change, obviously.
Okay.
It's not going to be stuck together. So they're going to come and group them in every specific interval. And then let's say it's 20 seconds for this example. Then you'd have three of those crosslinks in a one-minute interval, correct?
Mm-hmm.
That would be verifying all of these L1s. And then those three horizontal crosslinks will each have their own root hash. And those three root hashes then are hashed together with a nonce to create the proof-of-work situation, where the proof-of-work miners are actually weighting the crosslinks to say that they verified each one of these L2 crosslinks and they verified each one of these L1s. And then the chain of trust for miners that are associated, I weighted this data, I approved this data, and all of the L2s and the L1s, they're having a stake of that, where if there's any sort of conflict that's found, let's say later down by a verifier node, it's going to be easily distinguishable because they all verified it.
Okay. So for the miners, and I think this is an important distinction, is I get the analog piece, and it sounds like there's effectively always transactions going along, and they've got this initial gossip layer that starts running transactions in basically shards of...
They're not going to be gossip layer. They give each one of them as their own IP multicast point.
Meaning?
So IP multicast, unicast is like me talking to you and telling you a message, and then you talking to your friend and telling a message, and him passing it to Carl.
So that's serialized,
That's unicast, which means one at a time. Multicast is like we're doing right now. I'm talking to all three of you at once with the same message. And that's how each one of these state shard channels are going to happen. You're not only going to be sharding the data, but you're going to actually be sharding the network communication so that you don't have to flood the message to all of the nodes.
To
you send them to the nodes that are subscribed to that multicast link, which means that those transactions are relevant to them as a verifier.
Okay. So that, I'm assuming, is always happening, right?
Yes.
So that's a continual piece. So that's not split up into blocks, correct?
The L1 channels or the multicast?
L1. Yeah, the L1. So that's
no, the
not
L1s are the basis of a block. But yes, they're going to have you could call it a block-like structure if you want to call it what each one of them, let's say, of a 1 second or 5 second interval, they're going to be collecting the transaction hashes in there together and then chaining them together like L1s, right?
Okay.
Or like their own blockchain.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And then after a specific amount of those have been chained together, then that's when the L2 comes
in. That's when the L2 comes and groups them, yes.
Okay, cool.
And gets a root hash of them and checks each of the state channels.
Okay. And how many of those do you think they'll need to be L2s in order to hash and to validate enough of those state channels to make it, you know, robust enough?
I mean, I really wouldn't be able to say the exact number. I'd say a lot more than one.
Okay.
I mean, it's not really how many is going to give you a definite secure.
Correct, but
it's
at what point does it become?
It becomes a lot more secure. I mean, if you have 10, 20, 30, 40, 50%, it really is just variable of how much or how many people are doing it.
Okay.
You could say, that's like saying at what hash rate does this cryptocurrency become secure. It's not really about that. It's about what proportion of hash rate that exists can try to attack and manipulate that.
Yeah, okay. And then that third piece where the miners come in and then apply some proof of work to then validate the L2s, does that then, for the subsection of the L1, L2 validations that they try and validate, for that subsection, is that then portioned off as a block? Or not really?
No, miners are actually submitting shares. Think of it like a distributed pool. So miners are just going over data that's already been validated, let's say 1 minute ago, right, that's already in the structure, and they're just hashing the L2 locks with a nonce, right, and their own signature and their signature chain to prove that they're the miner that created that hash. And then at the end of the round, at the end of the next minute span, those miners are going to be awarded proportional to their work.
Okay. And is that going to be that reward structure, is that similar to the Bitcoin structure, winner-take-all kind of?
No, it's proportional to all of the shares that are submitted and witnessed by everybody, and then eventually reduced into a single hash.
Okay. I'm like 90%
I like
of the
this
way
guy.
There. I'm like,
oh yeah, he's giving me a hard time. I love it though.
You've asked questions in a way that I'm understanding this for the first time, and I've been listening to it for a long time. So nice work, Alex.
Cool.
Yeah, nice work. Good questions.
No worries, man. You're I'm like 80% of the way.
I'm thinking a lot more than I usually do in interviews this time too. Good questions.
Okay. We're going to have to do a round two after I digest this in the next six months, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then, like, come back to
it. We'll be here tomorrow.
Can you run through the reserve system and the emission structure? Because it's different to Bitcoin, and I guess it's something important for people to understand.
Yes.
And the logic behind it, the reason you chose that structure.
The reason I chose it is for two reasons. The first one is block reward halving creates a lot of, let's call it, stress on the economy. Every time there's a halving, the mining rewards cut in half overnight. And I've been a miner back in the days before I even built Nexus, and that was something that really kind of threw me the wrong way. As I said, well, this is pretty primitive. I mean, it's emulating radioactive decay as a half-life. So I said, well, why don't I just use the equation e to the negative kt, which is a normal radioactive decay model. And what I did with the reserve system then is, instead of saying, well, every block is going to have a reward slightly reduced, what I did is I said that every minute there's going to be a new reserve set, so that it decouples the block time from the actual emission schedule. So the reserves hold the potential maximum of Nexus that can be minted for the next foreseeable minute or 2 minutes, or the next foreseeable block. And if the reserves are over a certain amount of, let's say, a 20-minute supply, then the actual block reward for the miners is going to increase to a certain level, right? Which allows that reserve to slowly deplete and then go back to normal, and then the miner to return to a normal reward. Now, if the reserve becomes depleted below a 2.5-minute level, what's going to happen is you're going to get a fractional reward, which means that the total time it took for me to create this block is the only amount that I'm going to get according to the total emission that can happen in that minute. So it is an example. When Nexus was first launched, the rewards were about one Nexus for the first few hundred blocks, because the block time was so fast. Well, the difficulty caught up, there was nothing in the reserves. And as the difficulty caught up and the block time slowed down, it actually allowed the reserves to fill back up, and then the reward came back to normal and increased. And then the secondary benefit is the Prime channel was the very first channel that was actually launched. The hashing channel was launched 1 month after Nexus was launched. And what happened is, that very first block that was mined, the reserves had the total amount deposited for 1 month's worth of Nexus production, because each channel has 50% of the production. So what that made was about 1.5, 2 million Nexus appeared into that reserve, and then their reward was increased because there was over a 20 minutes value, and they slowly depleted that Nexus out of there. It took about a month or two for it to deplete and get back to normal, so that the supply distribution was equal between the two and they could operate independent of block time. So if we wanted to speed up the Nexus block time right now, it wouldn't change the supply rates. It would still come to the same amount produced every second, every minute, and I could look 1 year from now and know exactly how much Nexus is going to be minted. And I did that for an assurance, because Bitcoin, as you see, sometimes the block time is faster, sometimes it's slower, and there's no real definitive, I know exactly how much Bitcoin is going to exist at exactly this time. And so I did that as a measure of efficiency and a measure to not stress the markets, and a measure to also allow the block time to not affect the actual production, so that we could change those parameters at any time if we wanted to. Bitcoin, if they change their time to 5 minutes as a scaling solution, it would double the supply a lot quicker.
Yeah. I haven't done any reading on the reserve thing, so I'm like, that one's gone straight over my head. Can you tell me a little bit more about, actually, you know, I'll save that till later, because
okay.
I haven't read enough or looked into that aspect of it. You can ask about from a consumer standpoint, you know, let's say I walk into this whole new blockchain space and all this crypto shit that's happening, and everyone's launching a bullshit token left, right, and center every 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And, you know, one person says we're solving money and transactions. Someone else was saying we're solving global computing. Someone else says we're solving, you know, world poverty and hunger and fuck knows what else, right?
It's, right.
Everyone's solving some problem. And 99.9% of it is bullshit. But,
yep.
You know, I guess when I look at Bitcoin, for example, I don't view Bitcoin as much of a currency. I view the Bitcoin and the core chain as more of a, you know, settlement layer slash commodity slash, you know, reserve kind of asset. That's what I view it more as.
Yeah.
And then the abstraction of the Lightning Network, assuming they can get it all right, looks like it'll allow for people to transact fractions of Bitcoin on a network that is lighter and has a different crypto economic guarantee. Now, so that's Bitcoin aside, and I don't think Bitcoin should be used for, you know, doing things like, you know, what Ethereum's trying to do, for example. So I'm a big believer of horses for courses, like for thing. I mean, that could be an Australian saying, like,
yeah,
do the thing for the thing that it's meant to be, right? And Ethereum and EOS, for example, are going out there and saying, look, we're going to be the network for decentralized applications and things like that. And so me as an outside consumer, for example, or anybody that's listening to this, or anybody that comes into the industry, when they see Bitcoin, they say, all right, store of value. They see Litecoin, okay, transactional currency kind of thing. They see Ethereum, all right, dApps. They see IOTA claiming to be Internet of Things, whatever the fuck that means. But when they see Nexus, I don't know whether they're 100% sure. And I know I wasn't. I saw Nexus. Yeah. I was like, okay, this looks like an interesting project. I mean, for me, what drew me to it was that it was organically grown. And I like that. There was a Genesis block. So that were the first couple things. And to be honest, aside from that, I didn't really go further because there wasn't one specific piece that said, all right, that's the piece that Nexus is solving. So can you
the biggest thing is tying your identity to your data and tokenizing assets and actually having, I guess you could say it, an easy to integrate interface in order to access blockchain. So there's one, let's say, potential misunderstanding about the decentralized application framework is they've actually tied the logical tier with the data tier together, and that's created an erroneous amount of processing that needs to be done.
Yeah.
But the internet is tiered for specific reasons. You have the data, the logic, and the interface tier. So we're decoupling the data tier from the logical tier, and we're making it more register-based so that you're going to be able to establish data. You're going to have to own your data. You're going to own your identity. And with the identity being the SIG chain, you develop a trust and a reputation and a validation level on that. And then with the actual contracts, they're going to be API-based, and they're going to be standardized. So I think when people think about Nexus, they're going to think, well, what is Nexus? What is it for? Well, it's really for doing a great number of things in the world in the way that blockchain was meant to be. And that's why we need the 3D chain, because locking yourself into a blockchain architecture is still going to run into limitations. And then creating another blockchain to say, well, this is still going to work because I'm just going to make a blockchain over here. Well, you break the global validation state on that, and you degrade the consensus, because the total number of validators decreases every time you add a new chain and you open it up with more security pitfalls. So when people think about Nexus, I personally would like to think that I know with Nexus, I own my identity. I know with Nexus, I can transfer the ownership of my song. I can own my art. I can own my metadata. I can be my own person. I can utilize it to help me in the world, and I can use it as a transactional currency, or I can use it to create a DAO or any of those things. There's fundamental aspects of it that I think blockchain does well. And as you said, 99.9% of these projects out are a bunch of BS. And I mean, if you look back in the creation of Nexus, it was called CoinShield because it was the same pandemonium back then, just with clone coins. And so we were taking a stand against that. So I'm 100% with you on that. And I think that a lot of people are overstating the capability of blockchain right now.
Yep.
I think it's akin to the 99 bubble the internet, where everybody 100%. And their mom was, I'm going to make this and that and that. And there's a few core ones, this e-commerce, social media, search engines, and a few other things really became something on the internet. And I think that's going to be the same with distributed ledgers, what I generally like to call it, rather than blockchain, because I think it's a lot more than that. And we're fairly confident that we have that formula put together, and that when people see Nexus in 5 to 10 years, that's going to be a very clear statement. Well, what is Nexus for? Well, I use Nexus every day. Mm-hmm. I use it to stream my songs. I use it to publish my art. Okay. I use it to enter my house.
Okay, so it's more like an, so it's more akin then to like an internet-y infrastructure layer for other things to be built upon, right?
It's the data tier, which, I mean, if we get a little bit techie, think about it where you can record the state of your computation in a series associated with you, and you use it as a checkpointing system or a truth box to say, well, I have my own private network over here and I'm doing all of my own things on my private blockchain, but I can check that off of the main chain, let's say with checksums, or I can store references to this file, or somebody that accesses my medical records will have to sign on the actual blockchain or sign on Nexus in order to prove that they need access to it. And so it'll become an access point that you utilize to kind of have accounting or consistency with, well, this data, who owns this? Copyrights, how do I pay the licensor? How do I pay the person for their song? Well, I don't know how. It takes me 2 hours to figure it out. If you could give it as a push of a button where I just send a micropayment directly into that, it could hit a contract that, let's say this contract is associated with the ownership of metadata that is legally bound to the ownership of a song that then is tokenized, and there's a secondary market where people can buy tokens of this data, and then whenever you send a microtransaction for the licensing fees, that disperses to the token holders.
Okay. So you can... Yeah, so... All right. I'm with you on that. I think... In my humble opinion, I think that there needs to be probably a little bit more clarity. So after speaking with you, it's like I think because there's so much noise in this space.
Yep.
I think people are still confused as to what the
value proposition.
That's exactly the word I'm looking for.
And Colin can comment, and I'd also like to comment too that the marketing guys do a lot better job at that than me.
Cool.
Well, honestly, what you're pointing to is, as somebody who is not a tech person that come into this space, I can remember looking, well, there's all this myriad of stuff. And then you immediately can start to identify, well, there's a vast percentage that are just clone coins. Mm-hmm. Then there's some ideas that are really cool. But it does, having lived, so I joined a tech company in 2000.
Yep.
It was the last major funded, Wall Street funded tech company. We got $45 million in 2000 to build a retail stock management solution. And it was interesting being in the guts of the 99 boom, where everybody was like, I'm going to create this and it's going to do all that. And I had deja vu. Yeah, seriously, I hadn't really put it together, but it's exactly that craziness.
We're close to 98, 99, right?
Oh, really? The ICOs, we're going to do this, we're going to do this.
I know, it drives me insane.
Here's the thing that now, having been in the middle of Nexus for so long, the interesting thing is what drew me was the message, the feeling of hope. And it wasn't that Colin was saying, well, my blockchain is going to do this, or this blockchain is going to do that, or whatever. It was just that there's a new technology on the block. It has this potential. We're not really sure even what the potential is, but if we focus ourselves on seeing that we can serve as many people as possible, then we'll probably get where we want to be, even though we're not quite sure what that even looks like for 5 years.
Well, you touch on a very interesting point, which is, and sorry to cut you off on your train of thought, but I was going to mention it before when you were talking, Colin, is when the internet was first starting to gain adoption in the mid-90s, we had no idea that one of the main use cases for the internet would be fucking cat videos, right?
Right.
Like,
no,
seriously.
It's true.
Seriously.
It's true.
Or that we're going to take stupid selfies of ourselves and tell people what we're doing throughout our day on Instagram or some crap like that.
One of the best moments of your day is going to see some freaking meme that of some image that you had no clue about, but that like made your damn day, and you forwarded it to everybody you knew.
Correct. So I think, you know, initially, so I think we're at that stage where we think we're trying to speculate on where this new tech or where this new evolution is going to take us based on the framework or the mental models we have of today's problems and how we're trying to solve them with today's technology. So I think half of the shit that we're guessing now or speculating on now, we're going to completely miss. And there's probably 90% of the stuff that is going to happen later on are things that we can't even comprehend at the moment.
So
exactly.
So let me just continue there with my thought, because this is the thing that really gave me some condensed into some clarity for me. 3 weeks ago, we were at the Ernst & Young blockchain. Shout out to my Ernst & Young friends. The head of the blockchain initiative for Ernst & Young, and Ernst & Young, so as soon as you contemplate what an international CPA firm is, they're ultimately putting themselves out there as the ultimate referee. We are the people who get in between corporations and the people who access corporations as value, and we are the ones who say that these guys are acting in a fair mode, and so they're kind of like a referee node, let's call them.
A validator,
yep. Absolutely. Well, these guys have been in the blockchain space hardcore and investing big. I mean, they're already building some layer two solutions, supply chain management. It was an amazing thing to realize a lot of the things we're speculating on, they've got teams building it right now, and it's actually functional in certain ways. And that was a big eye-opener for me to realize, you know, this closed crypto community, for the most part, because you talk to mainstream friends and family, and they're like, whatever, you know, it's all going to go away. And then all of a sudden, here you got the largest validator of it, data in the world, is hardcore into this space. And not only, there's no question in their mind, but here's the moment that was a real eye-opener for me. The final presentation, Paul, the Global Blockchain Initiative head, stood up and said, from all the analysis that they've done, they foresee that to actually achieve the value of the blockchain, the potential the blockchain brings, that they project there will be one open source public blockchain in order to truly leverage the potential of blockchain effect in our lives. And he began to list the things that this blockchain would have to have: the speed, the scalability, the security, and all these things. And in fact, he, in a direct conversation, he said security for them was the number one. And as I contemplated it, I realized, and this is a big statement, you don't say Nexus is going to solve this problem or that problem or whatever. Colin's intention is to get, as I've heard him say, as close to the wire, or is, how do you take into
account? I mean, you got to look at a lot of areas when you get into scalability. I mean, that's why we even get down to layer three, which is a location identity separation protocol that allows us to do IP multicast rather than just relying on transport control protocol for the messaging. And that's something that I learned a lot from Dino Farinacci. He's really helped teach that and bring those aspects to it. And it's about getting as close to the hardware as possible so that you remove software bottlenecks. Right now, Bitcoin has a massive software bottleneck. The block size has been deliberately held low because the Lightning Network was, let's just say, what some people wanted over most people. And it generally degrades things into liquidity providers where you're not going to be able to open a Lightning channel unless you have the upper limit of your spending habits. And then if you don't have a route to somebody else, you're going to naturally have hubs form where people have to route through the hub in order to get to one another. And that's another word for banks, right? So there's certain aspects. That's why we believe in having it all done on the chain. And also to go out there and say, we don't have all the problems solved. We have a really good start at what we're figuring out, but we don't foresee everything that blockchain is going to be capable of. We're not entirely sure of it. That's why we go to businesses and we say, what do you need? What do you need from a blockchain? Here's how a blockchain works. What can we do to help you integrate? And also remove that disconnect between blockchain development and the people that use it. Right now, I feel like there's still a large, wide disconnect in a lot of those areas. And businesses that may try to build on a blockchain don't have a say over what it can do. And I think there needs to be more IETF-style working groups kind of like the internet utilizes now to standardize these processes and integrate these between businesses and blockchains.
So to continue then and to finalize, what I'm getting at is, if you've got a focus of we're going to solve this problem or we're going to solve this problem, what I have witnessed is Colin's approach is to say, let's just be something that serves as many as possible. Now, what are the things you're going to need to serve? You're going to need speed, scalability, security. So let's be that. Let's be this incredibly efficient, highly effective, speed, scalable, security solution, and then let people do whatever the hell they want on top of it. You want a solution that's got these characteristics. We're not going to say we're going to solve your music delivery problem or your car rental recovery
problem. You can build that solution on top.
We just create the thing that makes it so that when you want to create your solution, you create a solution. And I kind of think of it as the highway system.
Well, that's why it sounds more like the internet to me. Like, I mean, the original name for the internet, they were calling the information superhighway, right?
Superhighway. Yeah, and see, that's what I look at. I look at the net.
It's the information superhighway's truth box. That's what it is. If you want to see if this is the truth, you check it on the chain. Otherwise, you don't need to worry about having it on the chain. That's the biggest reason that it's going to be a very effective data layer, right? The data layer now in the Web 2.0 is the cloud, right? The data layer in the future, Web 3.0, is going to be the blockchain.
Yeah, okay. So the problem now you're saying is that that data layer is siloed, correct?
That what?
That it's siloed. So you're saying the data layer now is not truth boxed, for example, or so it's not accessible or transparent, all that sort of stuff. It's siloed.
It's still accessible and transparent to a certain extent, as long as it stays on chain and as long as the complexity is low enough for anybody to be able to utilize it.
I'm not so much talking about blockchains. I'm talking about the cloud or the internet.
Oh, the cloud. Yeah. You don't necessarily know. You don't have a globally accessible. How do I verify that what you're storing over there on yours is the same that he's saying is over here? And then how do you isolate the discrepancy where Mr. A over here whines that B is lying, and then you have to have an Ernst & Young type person say, okay, kids, let's stop correct. Fighting. But if you have a blockchain, you'd be like, that happened. Done.
Yeah.
So here's a reference hash, ID, correlate that. Look, your file, I hashed it. It's not that hash. Sorry, there's something up. Like, it's the truth. It happened. Everybody around the world agreed on it. It happened. Good luck.
Yep.
I mean, the next logical layer is going to be artificial intelligence. And then the next virtual layer or interface layer is going to be augmented reality and virtual reality. Everything's moving in that direction.
Yeah, okay.
And we're capturing and looking at that as another aspect, and that's where we get full circle into the hardware, too. Having new optical communication systems, having open source satellite technology that other people can use. Whether or not everybody's going to use it, I don't know. But the point is, if people have another option, that's all we can really do. It's up to people to do something with those options.
Yeah.
Let me just say one last thing here. Interestingly, having been somebody as a finance guy, which your job is to, in a trustworthy way, manage the finances of a corporation, okay? It's interesting that I worked my whole career, but it wasn't until I began to study blockchain that I realized the critical nature of trust. It changed the way I view every relationship I have in my life.
100%.
But understanding Nexus changed everything about...
That's the best. I guess, I don't mean to interrupt you, but just... The question that I didn't as effectively answer earlier, clearly, what's the value proposition? I mean, trust is a huge one.
And that's exactly
really, a mathematical trust, besides just proof of work being your trust, but your track record of your proof of work or your proof of time. That's, and then tying that to your identity and tying that to your data, I'd say that's the formula that, in the most simplified expression that I can say.
Yep.
And that's what I was getting to when I was talking about Ernst & Young, is that the realization, and actually today, you guys have really helped me get some clarity on what Nexus is about, because I realize now it is what I would call now the trust layer of the internet. So we've got the internet and all kinds of shit flows through it. We know that, and you never know. But all of a sudden, where Ernst & Young has been this validator in traditional, I'd call analog serial business, what I can see now is Nexus is actually just creating a trust layer that's going to flow. And with Dino's help and you guys, what you're doing right now, breaking out the protocols to flow on the different layers of the internet, we're literally creating the trust layer of the internet.
And to be fair, IP multicast never really took off. And people at the IETF laugh and they say, oh, yeah, you're still trying to do IP multicast, Dino? And it's like, well, maybe it just hasn't found the perfect use case. Now we believe we have it.
Yeah.
And that's what's going to be really unique to see it. I mean, message propagation is going to be extremely quick. Yeah. And then different in IP multicast, you can actually control authorization. You have authorized people into the IP multicast links. So you have security built on the network layers as well. So you can protect it from DOS attacks and everything. And then you tie that or your EID with your trust key on the ledger too, so that your routing location or your fixed prefix, I mean, think of the routing locators as down here, and your EID is kind of a higher layer that resolves your routing locators, which would just be dynamic IP addresses or Bluetooth links or whatever. But tying that, your routing layer, specifically to your trust key on the ledger, and then assigning that, other people can know, okay, well, I know you because now I can look you up and I can see what you've done and I can know if I want to interact with you. And then when nodes themselves build a relationship with one another, that opens up a whole other door where the network then is able to see its own state, see what normally happens in, let's say, an L1 channel, what's a normal flow of information. And then when it can have that track record, it has something to measure itself against. And when it can measure itself against something, you can therefore see a bad actor coming in and, let's say, in trying to inject bad data or do bad things, quote unquote. And then the network can start to detect. And I kind of consider that a bit of a distributed immune system, where the network can know itself. And when the network knows itself, it can know what it's not. And when it knows what it's not, it's easy to identify those that are bad actors in the system.
Yep. Okay. I'm actually going to almost say that, to me, Nexus doesn't even sound like... I think the term blockchain got popularized in 2015.
We're Nexus not a blockchain.
Exactly, not
no.
a blockchain. And I think that's an important consideration here.
Don't say that word. no, it's... I mean... I had been saying distributed ledger lately, but then I just was informed that ledger deals with just financial transactions. So if you guys got any better names, we're still working on finding that.
To me, network sounds like the best thing. It sounds like a network infrastructure. It sounds like an architecture layer.
Distributed network.
Else. Yeah. So there you go.
Yeah, I actually kind of like that. Or distributed Nexus. Yeah, I like that. I'll think on that. Yeah.
Interesting. All right. Yeah.
Thanks, Alex.
No worries, man.
Yeah.
I have one good idea a year. And that's it.
I bet you got a lot more than that, man.
Okay. Look, I think for the sake of time, unless you guys want to dig into some other things, like I could sense in your comment before around, Bitcoin scaling debate and, you know, moving things off chain and on chain. Do you feel like going for a conversation down that path, or?
It's really just simple economics. What happens is, if you need to make transactions in a Lightning channel and you need to have a certain number of Bitcoins in order to transact with the maximum amount that you could transact with, and then you need to have a Lightning channel open with somebody through somebody through somebody through somebody to actually get a route, it's going to just form hubs. It's going to form liquidity providers.
Do you think it forms hubs? Because I think that actually... the fact that there's no minimum or no maximum, and the fact that you've got bidirectional channels.
Yeah, but if I want to send you 2 Bitcoins, but we only have a channel open with 1 Bitcoin, we need another Bitcoin in order to send it. You need to have the maximum amount you could possibly send. And if I want to send to, let's say, your friend, and there's only 1 Bitcoin between us, but I want to send him 2 Bitcoins, then I'm going to have to find another route that has
true,
2 Bitcoins.
But I don't think you would send
it.
2 Bitcoin on an off-chain transaction. I think 2 Bitcoin warrants
it
just
could.
Doing an on-chain transaction.
But, I mean, let's look at the valuation, right? I mean, the Bitcoin transaction fee is based upon the Satoshis per kilobyte.
Mm-hmm.
Now Bitcoin's worth $9,000 right now. What happens when it's worth 100? How expensive is it going to be to open up these Lightning channels? What happens when it's worth 500,000? Because Bitcoin reaching gold's market capitalization would make Bitcoins worth about $450,000 per Bitcoin.
Yeah, correct. So then in that case, Lightning channels can still be run with 0.1 of a Bitcoin, and
you could.
I think that abstraction layer. I'm a big believer that, good architecture means you have, and it almost sounds like what you were talking about with Nexus before is acting as that settlement layer. Is that, you know, applications
generally,
so
yes,
microtransactions and transactions between us are actually an application atop a settlement layer. So the settlement layer is the source of truth. And it's the piece
somewhat,
that doesn't
yeah.
change.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there is a whole mesh network of, Lightning nodes, which have their own crypto economic guarantees. So you open a Lightning node, and if you try to fuck someone over, you're going to lose what you've staked. So it's almost
partially,
like layering proof of stake over.
But when you have multiple channels, you rely on the trust of everybody in those linked channels to be trustworthy and record an accurate state. Otherwise, your Bitcoins are in limbo for 30 days, unless you have the multi-sig to sign it back on. And so what's naturally going to happen economically is people are going to need to transact with one another, but they're not going to be able to open up channels. So what they're going to do is they're going to open up a channel with the liquidity provider, aka a checking account. And then the liquidity provider is going to connect everybody together so that you can transact with one another. And it's going to feel like it's Bitcoin in your own mind, but it's really not going to be, because they're going to have to record a consistent state of all of the account balances and prevent bad actors. So then they're going to have fraud departments, and then they're going to have to do KYC, know your customer, because you're going to be a customer into these liquidity providers. And then we get back into Blockstream's founding, right? Which they're the ones that have pushed the Lightning Network agenda. They were founded in 2014 by the chairman of the Bilderberg Group, who owns AXA Ventures. And AXA Ventures was a main funder of the actual Blockstream protocol. If you look at the anti-Bitcoin sentiment, it went from anti-Bitcoin to anti-anybody against Blockstream. And so I've put these pieces together and study the economics of it, and I just can't foresee how it's going to become an effective means of transacting with one another without liquidity providers and without hubs forming.
I still disagree with that. Only
fine.
Because I think the... There might be requirement for some level of hubs, but from the research I've done, and I think it's outside the scope of this discussion anyway, is I think that the fact that there is bidirectional channels means that whenever payments go one way or another, the channels end up being replenished anyway, and I don't think that layer is going to be used for larger transactions.
If we want to send bidirectionally, aren't you usually just doing a one-time payment? If I need to send you some Bitcoin, then what's the point of opening a channel? If I'm just going to send you Bitcoin once, then I'm going to have to settle on the blockchain, and then we're going to send the transaction back and forth, and then we're going to have to settle again. I mean, there's going to be very little point. Let's say maybe I have a pizza shop that I want to transact with. Mm-hmm. Well, the pizza shop's generally going to start to become a liquidity provider, because then you can go through the pizza shop to find other people, and then the pizza shop's going to start accumulating more and more Bitcoins in their channels, and then it's going to get more and more people, and it's going to become more and more favorable to use the Bitcoin shop or the pizza shop until they say, hey, wait, why am I going to be a pizza shop? I can make more money doing this and selling pizza. I'll be a bank.
But that's not necessarily a bad thing, because then you've got another layer of validators.
I never said it's a bad thing, but what I am saying is that it's against the principles that Bitcoin was founded on. And that's my only reason that I take the position that I have of believing the transactions should be settled on the chain, because you then degrade the truth box into somebody's truth company. And their truth company is the one that therefore decides. And if there's a dispute, then you have to wait 30 days for the dispute to clear and the channel to close automatically. If you have, let's say, a checked lock time verify on the channel, you know, but still, that means my Bitcoins are in limbo for 30 days just because this truth box over here says, oh no, my truth's more valid than your truth because I got all the Lightning channels and you're just one little channel punk. Cool, you can wait 30 days. It doesn't matter. I got 100 other channels open.
Although the likelihood of that happening, I mean, so that's where you have the guarantee that if they want to do something fraudulent, they're going to lose a big chunk of their stake.
No, they're not going to do anything fraudulent, but they can withhold from that money being ever cleared until that 30-day limit. They can stop and be uncooperative. And if they do accumulate a lot of open channels, right, then other people are going to still need to use them. And when it becomes increasingly more and more expensive to settle on the main Bitcoin blockchain, people aren't going to have a choice. When people had $70 worth of Bitcoin back in the day and they're like, oh my gosh, it cost me $50 to send this, I can't even put gas in my car. It's just now this is my opinion. This comes from my own knowledge. I'm not stating what I say is an absolute truth, but from my study of the economics and the technology of it, I can't see how it's going to work in a way that's favorable to people like Bitcoin was founded upon.
And so with that being said, I think what we're witnessing here is exactly what's going to happen in the space, and that is people are going to come up with solutions when we're faced with the challenges, so that the challenges of Bitcoin scalability is created the opportunity for the Lightning Network, and the Lightning Network is going to serve people for a while, and it'll function just like what you're saying. There will,
my principles.
And that's
people don't want to use it. That's fine, but that's where the beauty of new projects comes in.
That's my point. Is that until the new solution quits being an efficient solution, or until a new contrasting solution comes to the front, it's the perfect solution.
Yeah.
It's not good, bad, right, or wrong.
I agree 100%, and I mean, the idea of, yes, block size increases will cause problems over the period of time. Satoshi, like I said at the beginning of the interview, stated that that's the scaling solution on Moore's Law. I figure by the time Bitcoin's big, it's not going to be a problem to send an HD movie over the internet. It's like, well, yeah, it's not just the bandwidth. It's also the verifying of all of your signatures and so on and so forth. I mean, and I think there's merit to their idea in doing it. I think the Bitcoin core developers have done a very good job in taking Bitcoin to the level it's at. Now, morally, I believe that there's ways to do it on chain that are going to be effective. And that's what we're going to be seeing happen as this three-dimensional chain is built out. And if that becomes a better option for people, great. But, you know, providing more options in the space is, I think, something that's very necessary instead of being limited by just one.
That's it.
Yep.
And we're just another option.
And ultimately, it really gets down to that moment where I think of the big jumps in technological evolution that pushed humanity forward, like the printing press or the Henry Ford's
the
manufacturing methodology and stuff. What I look at it is this. This whole scene is just freaking exciting. I mean, it's just fun. You wake up every day and somebody else has done something.
That's,
and you're like,
today.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, seriously, man.
It's like $100 million hacked.
Or either $100 million hacked or a new thing. And then you're like, God, I never thought of that. But that's brilliant. I mean, seriously, a year ago when Ethereum mooned, and you're like, could you believe that the thing that kind of brought it to its knees was a fucking crypto game?
Oh, that reminds me, if you guys seen, what's the TV show, the Game of Thrones?
I haven't watched it, but...
You've seen it? I got to show you the meme with all the crypto coins and Game of Thrones characters. Yeah. Yeah, funny stuff. But anyway,
it's a
great experience. And you meet a really interesting group of people all around the world. That's one of my favorite parts about it, is the diverse opinions and everybody able to express and form their own opinions and have the freedom to choose what resonates with them the most. That's something that I really like about it.
Do you see the technology that you're working on getting integrated into Bitcoin at all, by any chance?
I would hope. I mean, I'm not building it just for us exclusively. Yeah. I mean, that's part of one of the original principles back in the day, is people say, you're here to compete with Bitcoin? We're like, not really. We're here to cooperate and build new technology and hope that other people find it useful, and if they find it useful, then they'll implement it too. And that's where the Tao comes in. Yeah, Bitcoin could theoretically upgrade it. Now, that would require a massive consensus, which we've seen is a little bit challenging for Bitcoin to come to. But that would be a hope, that it could produce value beyond just Nexus. And we're proving the model and charging into the unknown and figuring out things and breaking things and making things work at the same time. And from that, hopefully Bitcoin or Litecoin or Ethereum or any other coin would find it useful and utilize it.
Great. My next question is more around the SEC stuff that you were talking about last night. Are you able to just run through that? Are you able to just reiterate what you went through last night at the meetup with the issues with the SEC?
Yeah, in the U.S., the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, basically came out and said a broad-based statement that we consider every cryptocurrency to be a security until you prove otherwise, basically. And so with that, from our perspective, and this maybe speaks to one of the aspects you don't know about that is part of Colin's original vision, and that is the So let me get, I'll go through the SEC stuff, then I'll talk about the Nexus Embassy.
Sure.
With that being said, there are certain aspects of security that it's very clear that a lot of the ICOs, people trying to gain value by a promise to deliver something in the future from somebody else. And as you've stated very well, Alex, most of that's bullshit. And the SEC recognized that a lot of people were losing a lot of money on these blue skies. So the big crash in 1929 created in the U.S. what are called blue sky laws, and that was the fundamental core that was underlying the creation of the SEC. Blue sky is the idea of you got all these ideas, blue sky ideas, and now I'm going to sell those to you, and you're screwed basically because I'm going to take your money and you're going to never see me again. Yeah. So I'm not that opposed to the position they've taken because I think what it's done is it's finally got the market a little bit more under control and got these people out who are just scammers. But now we're getting down to brass tacks of saying, well, then what are you? If you're not a security, what are you? Well, a utility? Are you a commodity? Are you a store of value? I mean, what are you? And ultimately, I think that there are... it's to be determined, but until that time, we have to manage ourselves as if we're subject to the security laws, and so we have to manage how we communicate. We have to manage promises that or statements of promise that we make, and so that's very at times it's frustrating, but at the same time we understand that there's a value in doing that with bad actors so that it levels the playing field for the people who are potentially trying to get into this space. Ultimately, we feel confident that we'll probably fall under something like what the SEC chairman just came out in the last week and stated that Ethereum is not a security. And he listed certain aspects that we feel apply to us as
they
well.
They have stated that?
Oh, yeah, just this last week. Okay. He came out and stated Ethereum is not a security. And he quoted the... fact that it's a functioning blockchain.
Okay.
The fact that it's got utility, there are dApps on it that are actually providing service, like kitties and you know things. And he pointed to those things as saying, these by definition make it not a security. Well, we feel that that's ultimately where we're going to fit as well. But until that time, we're going to treat ourselves, or we're going to act as if we are, until we can show that we are not. Ultimately, what it gets down to, and this is the twist that for us is really unique. Colin, when he created the code, witnessed the infighting that was occurring in the Bitcoin space. And that control of the code was the thing that was causing the problem. So
everybody
what?
Everybody
wanted it increased, but there were people who said no. So what Colin... did, which I think was brilliant, is he coded into Nexus
this is where we get back to the reserves. So there's multiple reserves per channel. So there's an ambassador reserve, which is the theoretical maximum amount of mint that can go into an ambassador key. And then there's a developer reserve, which is the theoretical maximum that can be minted into a developer key. So right now there's 13 developer keys and 13 ambassador keys, and what they're designed to do is create sovereign, self-funded organizations that act as the democratic consensus mechanism for the stewardship of the network. Bitcoin, I say, is akin to an abandoned baby. It was thrown out there and it didn't have any parents, so of course you have some that come in and then they trained it the way they wanted to train it. And we believe that there should be a more distributed legal structuring and distributed development as well, where developers don't rely on external funding in order to continue to maintain the network. They can essentially be paid directly from the network through a democratic vote. So right now, since the technology is not complete with the 3DC and the distributed autonomous community, they're hard-coded, so they have to be carefully selected to individuals that aren't going to abuse that right. And so right now, that's where
this... How do you determine that, though?
I mean... how you determine it with other people, it's a limited thing. And I mean, it's still got some forms of decentralizing from its, you know, central leadership right now in the Nexus Embassy. And the next step is getting an Australian Nexus Embassy set up. That's the biggest reason I came down here, to find the right stewards. And I mean, you use intuition, you use experience, you make sure that you give them to the right people.
Do you mind if I just comment? So to back up a little quick, the ambassador and developer keys are part of every block that's mined in Nexus. There's a percentage that goes into these keys to fund these caretakers, these stewards, and that's the basis of which the Nexus Embassy, which is a U.S.-based nonprofit corporation, is the entity within which we are accumulating the management team and the developers who are the stewards of this blockchain.
Similarity there to Dash, right? With the treasury?
Yeah, it's similar, but the Dash treasury, it's basically got their DAO making the votes from masternodes, and then Evan Duffield up at the top approving all proposals. It's all done manually. It's still a bit of an illusion. It's, I think, a little premature for a blockchain to be capable of doing what a DAO truly is going to do. But yes, the concept is similar to the Dash treasury, but it's not going to be a treasury. It's going to be multiple all around. So as the network becomes more and more capable and the price goes to a point where it can support more embassies, then more of them will pop up. Right now, Australia is the next big step, New Zealand, UK, Poland, and the U.S., like we have, and then we're probably going to open another one in L.A., and the idea is each one of them being independently operated. They're all nonprofits owned by nobody, so that's why we chose that as a structure, but they're going to be independently operated so that they form a democratic consensus and form the foundations for when the distributed autonomous community is completed in the Obsidian update, which will be around 2020, then ambassadors will then transition to ambassador contracts, like we were stating earlier, and they're going to have to be ratified by the network, republic style instead of democratically. So there's going to be six voting groups, which are six resource contributors, the L1 trust, like you remember, and then the L2, and then the L3, and then you have the currency and developer and ambassadors. So all six of them together will form a consensus to validate or ratify new ambassador contracts, or to, let's say, have certain ambassador contracts canceled if they didn't, let's say, proceed to the specifications or to the intentions that they stated. And it creates a more accountability in the ability for the governance to happen, because not everybody wants to step up and be a steward or govern, or it's a lot of work. I mean, including doing interviews like this or building all the code and answering very difficult questions. And it's not up for everybody, but some people that want to step up, they should all have that equal opportunity to do so. And that's the idea with these contracts. Same with the developers. The developer contracts would be the same. Hi, I'd like to work for Nexus. Here's my resume. And the petition goes out, everybody votes on it. When it's ratified, then they get hired and they get paid on a weekly or monthly basis. And then if, let's say, this contract, you know, they fail or they mess up or they're proven incompetent, then the public goes and votes it and they vote them in and out. So this embassy that we operate right now is going to become under a democratic contract in 2020 or not. If we don't do well and people don't like it, we're not going to be voted in. But that's not to stop us from developing the technology to its full maturity.
And with that being said, right now there is no voting, just to be clear, speaking to the SEC. Mm-hmm. There is no voting. That doesn't exist. This is obviously something that is coming and we'll be working on. But the idea is, you asked the question, is how do you choose those people you trust? Well, the great thing is it works a lot like Nexus. Colin created this incredible mathematical trust function that you, with math and time and your consistent performance, you actually mathematically create trust. Well, the same thing is, you guys were at our meetup last night. We met some of the guys face to face who we know not by no other means but a Slack handle for years. It was. It's so cool. You meet some guy who, Mercury Miner, Paul Screen, two Aussies were there the day that Colin launched Nexus in 2014, and they mined some of the very first blocks in the world of Nexus. And guess what? We trust those dudes. We trust those guys. They've been in. We've been talking to them on Slack for years. And you see somebody like that you've never seen before, but you know which ones are a bit of a dick. You know which ones. And you feel their passion for the project and their level of commitment. And so at that point, I'm not kidding, man. There's people that I've met for the first time personally, face-to-face. Like there's a kid from Canberra, Chris Murdoch. Him and his girlfriend came to Vegas. I've literally met him one time before, but I've known him for almost 2 years on Slack. I drove down to the New York hotel, grabbed him and cooked a steak for him at my house because I trust him because I know him. And that's kind of what I feel like we're trying to accomplish with the embassy, is once these relationships get built over time, we got people all over the world who are involved in the Nexus community that you know, but you kind of don't really know. You know what I mean? Mm.
I just wanted to add one little sentiment. I mean, in my opinion, my perspective, Nexus is a big family. And we get to know each other and we build. And I mean, yeah. I mean, it's really cool to see all these people and see, I mean, especially start planning the seat of the embassy out here. I mean, it looks like Merck and Paul. I mean, they're kind of choosing themselves, too. It's not like I go, you're building the embassy. I'm just like, hey, guys, who wants to build an embassy?
to that point, there's a guy here, Mike Casey, who's just, you just show up. I mean, honestly, that's how I've landed where I'm at. I was so passionate and wouldn't basically leave these people alone. And they finally said, okay, you know, you're in.
Yeah. How do you, so I'm going to ask, again, a contrarian question.
All right.
How do you solve for the scenario where, you know, you end up selecting a bunch of embassy stewards who are all, I guess, got the Pollyanna syndrome. It's like, yeah, we all agree, and that's it. And you end up with a situation where people are sincere, but let's say... And not in a derogatory sense, but sincerely incompetent.
Right.
You know, and you end up in a situation where you've got all of these embassies that all agree, but agree on something that is...
incompetent.
Correct, and they fuck it all up.
Well, I mean, that's a good... I like how you're playing devil's advocate. I appreciate that, because, I mean, that always strengthens ideas. And ultimately, that just comes down to education and awareness and us all just being the best people we can be and setting examples of being more capable and studying what other people do from their capability and being able to distinguish knowing what we may not know. And so if there's levels of incompetence, that's where a challenge comes in, because all of us would collectively have to be incompetent,
yeah.
Which would be a pretty...
That's where the probabilities...
That would be a very challenging situation. Generally, people checking and balancing and not having a central point of failure, usually with a central leader, that person being incompetent potentially... causes the whole thing to become incompetent because they're the one calling all the shots. But when you have more checks and balances, the probabilities do drastically increase that people will catch each other. And that's what we notice too. If there's any bad ideas that any of us state, we all call each other on it and we're not afraid to it. Even like you stating these questions and saying, well, what about this scenario and what about that? That's the general kind of consensus that happens, where we all talk about different things and we don't view one person above one other person. We come to consensus together. Even like we were discussing last night with a couple changes to the protocol. And me and Merck and Paul Screen and all of us, and we're coming together to a consensus. Well, what about this? Well, I think this. Well, this is my point and this is my position with that. Well, maybe we should try this and this. And then, okay, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's move forward with that. And generally, that's how it works. But, you know, not isolating yourself to thinking that you know everything is the best solution to that scenario. Because as soon as you think you know, you shut yourself off from allowing new information to come in. So just remaining open and honest and being honest with yourself and allowing people to teach you as well as you teach them, that's how you stop that.
I think the biggest, so I'm just going to make a comment, I think the biggest strength in these types of, you know, decentralized decision or consensus making mechanisms is also their biggest weakness, is the sense that sometimes, you know, dictatorships, for example, are far more efficient because you can go from decision to action very quickly.
Yeah.
Whereas I think one of the problems we've got in this whole new crypto space is that everyone wants to do everything fucking decentralized and then nobody makes a decision about anything.
Collective incompetence.
Correct, exactly. And then you end up in a situation where everyone just spends their time arguing. And I think Bitcoin's a good example of that, is that it's, you know, the feature is the bug. That, you know, at the same time, whilst anyone can have an opinion, you end up in a situation where, I guess a good analogy that I heard Nick Szabo mention is that you've got the nuclear reactor engineers saying, you know, we should do this, and then a bunch of people who say, no, we should do this, but they're not nuclear engineers. So, and sometimes you end up with a situation where, due to limited understanding, for example, the broader consensus might be to take the rod out, and, you know, then they...
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And then you fucking blow everything up. So I think, you know, there's the potential, and it's going to be really interesting. I guess this is not a question, really. This is one of the things I find interesting about the space and what we'll see over the coming 5-10 years is how this feature in these decentralized consensus mechanisms also becomes a problem, and then how we figure out ways to solve them.
Education.
Through it.
Social technology. That's why I always say, you know, giving somebody Bitcoin or complete access to that is like giving a two-year-old a hammer. Yep. They're going to run around, and, I mean, things don't end well. You got to teach people how to utilize it, teach people how to think for themselves. And we're coming out of this kind of, I guess you can call it a form of indentured slavery, where people are, they're kept stupid. Mm-hmm. And they're kept that way so that the nuclear engineers can be like, oh, no, you don't know what I'm talking about. So I'm going to make all the decisions for you. I'm your president, dun-dun-dun. And that type of scenario does happen. So I think helping elevate people and creating something that helps elevate people is going to be something that's going to be very pivotal in these coming times. Because if people are incompetent or continually incompetent, yes, the democracy is going to fail.
Yeah. Although I think there needs to be an incentive layer for people to want to participate in that. Because from what I've found is that most people are happy being ignorant.
Yeah.
Or most people are happy just having the shit served to them. Because, you know, I guess the general public or the general population that you speak to, their highest goal in life would be to do nothing and make money, right?
I would argue, though, that they don't know anything else. And that's the thing. I've noticed people, I've seen people come into Nexus time after time saying, when Moon, when Lambo, money, 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 right? Then 6 months later, they start talking about philosophy and they start getting into it and realizing, wait, my purpose, fulfilling myself. Once you give somebody a taste of true freedom or a taste of purpose or a taste of true fulfillment, they ain't gonna waste their time with all that other BS. They're gonna see it. But when people don't have that, that's where you have a, so there's an internal incentive that may not just be monetary, that as you be an example of that and set that example, and more people create a network effect of that specific, here's a bunch of sovereign people living out their true purpose and their passions that are happy. Wait, I want to be happy too. Like, what are these guys doing that I'm not doing? And
it
spreads.
So, and I think what we're talking about now is a layer or a level to Nexus that we don't talk about openly very often, because ultimately the way I connected here, I look at it from a very esoteric worldview. What we're talking about is the evolution of humanity, the evolution of consciousness, because you made a statement, most people just want to do nothing and get what they need, and that points to a certain level of evolution as far as what I'm seeking from my existence. But what we're talking about here ultimately is, and one of the things about crypto is awesome is, you're gonna be your own banker, man. You're gonna hold your wallet, and it's potentially gonna have a big bag of value, and are you gonna take that personal responsibility? And there's a lot of people, once I've shown them, look, this is your wallet, it could potentially have thousands of dollars in it, and they don't even like that idea. I don't wanna do that. I want somebody else to do it, because I might mess it up or whatever. But what we're talking about here, I think at a deep level, because if you just look at humanity, and there's a time when I was really hating on the bankers, you know? But the truth of the matter is, without the evolution of the corporate structures, and without the evolution of the banking system,
we wouldn't be here right now. I had this conversation with someone the other day.
Honestly, excuse me, back in the day when these ideas first started coming to the forefront, they were hailed as, oh my God, this is great. This is a great step in consciousness.
The banking revolution was what we are today back then.
That's exactly right.
Moved from the oligarchy to...
And the people that were living under the environment of no centralized value structure and no guardian of the value and no third-party intermediary between you and I to make sure that I don't screw you and you don't screw me. Mm-hmm. The people that lived in that world and saw the value of this are like hailing it as like this huge step in evolution. This is great. And now we're at this place going, oh, God, those bastards that are the third-party intermediaries trying to control the world and all this stuff. But in their day, they were a massive step in evolution. Yep. And once you start to look at the world like that, once you start to look at the world of let's raise the consciousness, let's raise the hopes and the dreams and the values of the world.
Yep.
Now you step into the place of, who the hell do you think you are? You know, you're just a fucking accountant from the States, you know, whatever. That you can give the list of names that you want to, labels you want to put on people to limit them. And what we're saying is, no limits, man. No limits. Let's just create a world where you got a better idea than Nexus. Go for it. You know, you got another idea that's going to completely knock us off our feet and sweep the world into a new layer of consciousness. Teach us. We're open, you know. Yeah. You've asked Colin some pretty direct questions here. And one of the things I love about this guy is, like last night, we're having this great meetup. Three of the miners cornered him and were like, what about this and what about this and what about this?
And sometimes it's just like, I don't have that all figured out yet.
But we'll ultimately, well, and that's the thing, is what nobody saw last night is several of the miners sat with Colin and they came to a consensus, and there's going to be some changes in the code, and it's a cool experience. But see, if Colin had come in and said, I'm the creator, I'm the owner, I'm the boss. Exactly. Yeah. You're just this. Shut up. And that's where I see this level of evolution going, where somebody like you, Alex, Mitch,
Justin.
Sorry, Justin, yeah, man. Yeah, no, I was like this whole time. Seriously, the whole time I'm like.
I'm domineering.
But the point, being is, to be able to openly ask questions like this of someone who's making these kind of claims and then saying, okay, that either makes sense or you call bullshit, you know? We want people to call bullshit.
That's what creates something robust.
That's it.
We want people to give all of their game theory and say, well, I can do this to that, or what if I did this? Be like, oh, gee, I didn't think about that, but I'll get back to you about that tomorrow. I'm going to do some thinking about it. Yeah, we don't know what we don't know, and that's how we become stronger together. We all kind of work together to build that, and that's what's going to make a public system like this successful, is everybody working together towards a common goal.
And one of the things that I've loved as an old mate, because I am the old guy in the block at the leadership team, but one of the things that's been amazing to me is once I started to understand game theory a little bit more and hear these guys talk about it, at first it was like, I don't know what that is, done a little reading. What I've started to do is apply game theory to life.
Yeah.
And that's all you do, is you're given a puzzle, and now you have a certain number of tools, and now you apply those tools. But then when you find some people who you vibe with, who have a similar worldview, and who are willing to attack the big puzzles of life, how do we help the people?
That don't want to be helped.
No.
I was talking to this guy from Turkmenistan, and he says, so, yeah, we have the second worst dictator below North Korea and blah, 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 and all these problems. And he's like, the real problem is, though, they need to be a dictator, because if he steps down as a dictator, another dictator is going to come and take over, because people don't know what to do. They want the dictator. And it reminded me of Game of Thrones. He's like, how do I free slaves that want to be slaves? They're like, miss, you freed me, but can I please go back to my master? I'm scared. I want to be back there. Yeah, it's like, how do you – I mean – I can only think of just being an example of something that you know that you personally like to be, and then hopefully it inspires people.
Have you guys looked at an evolutionary model called spiral dynamics?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, cool,
yes,
yeah.
Exactly. So to that point, all you have to do is look at the visual representation of the golden ratio, and that's it. That's exactly it. We create a new box of reality with our mental construct, and then our individuality is that spiral that shoots through. And we hit up against that wall of that mental construct, and you hit against it, and you hit against it, and a couple other people start hitting against it.
And then you break through it.
And you break through it. The key is to remember that all you did is move into a new mental construct.
Correct.
You didn't reach nirvana.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's right.
And as long as you keep that in mind and always remember that your mental construct is just a version of reality that there's another version of, and that's when life gets fun.
That's it. Yeah, 100%.
Cheers.
Fuck.
I love you guys.
Yeah, you guys are dope.
I had a...
I can see we can hang out for a while.
100%, man. 100%.
Yeah.
I'm gonna even stop.
I had another question there, and I just lost it. Around... what was it? Fuck, it'll come back to me. It's gone. Excuse.
No, did I you can tell you right now, I'd love to stay in touch with you guys.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, we'll keep chatting.
I'd really love it. So, look, let's just for the sake of time and for the sake of the people listening to this, I think this is going to turn into a 5-hour.
Is that how long it's been? Let's see.
How long have we run so far?
That's 2 hours.
2 hours, okay, cool.
2 hours. That's good. Okay, me and Ernest Hancock did 17 and a half hours once.
Okay.
Yeah, teaching him about blockchain. That was. Right.
We should do a part two and try to go for 20 hours, man.
Yeah.
Let's wrap it up on this then. So, how do people, if they want to get involved, you know, and participate in some way, shape, or form in Nexus. How do they do that?
I mean, you can get involved with the currency. Join Slack, nexuserth.slack.com. Go to the website, nexuserth.com. You can check it out on Facebook. I think our page is NXS Earth. Twitter handle is NXS Earth. Just find us on any one of the channels. Talk to anybody on the team. Figure out, I mean, if you want to get involved, send your resume in. If you want to just contribute, we have kind of a distributed social organizational system. Yeah, based on research from John David Garcia about groups of eight, and groups of eight being the most creative combination, and them all working together as one and taking a certain project on and then being accountable to one another, and they can work on bounties. So you can, in Slack, join a pod, do different things like that. I mean, really ultimately get involved if you want to get involved and bring to the table whatever you see being valuable, whether it's not knowing that or not.
Sorry, let me just say. So, for example, our booth here.
Yep.
Nexus Embassy had nothing to do with that booth.
Yep, that was
that
the boys.
That whole booth,
yeah.
The backdrop, the guys manning it, that those guys are guys who have connected with this vision, connected with this dream, and have just said basically, we're going to help, and they're doing it.
Yep.
And it's what's happening around the world, man.
Now, I mean, the step is to get them self-funded with their own, you know, legal structure and everything like that. I mean, they're already, see, like you say, how do you choose? They chose themselves.
Yeah.
And then they just invited us out here, and we're just along for the ride with them.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
It's like distributed intelligence, you know, in effect.
They're doing their own thing.
Yeah.
So
rather
than being like a traditional hierarchical structure, you've got, essentially, it's a distributed structure.
And a voluntary system.
Yeah. There's brains everywhere in the system.
Yeah. You can be a part of it or not at any time.
I remember what I was going to say before was when we were talking about game theory. You mentioned something about everybody working together toward a common goal. And I think, I'm not going to correct you, but I think game theory is everybody working in their own self-interest toward a common goal.
See, and that is very true. And you need to know the game theory to create a system that creates incentives to not be that way eventually. Because when the world is just, I guess I always use the analogy, you got to show people what's inherently in their best interest. What they don't realize right now is that their pursuit of just their own goals and their own getting from the world is actually not in their best interest. It's actually in their best interest to work with other people because they're going to find a greater fulfillment. They're going to find a greater happiness. We seek relationships and love because that's inherently in our self-interest. But yet, the way the universe works is it ascends and it transcends that self-interest into love, where you seek it because you desire the person, but then you begin to genuinely, deeply care about them.
Yeah, correct. So it's almost the survival mechanism. So
it's a lower vibrational construct. It's a lower vibrational. It's a small part of that inner spiral. And what we're doing is building bridges into the different one, into the next, into the next. And that's partly by bridging and showing people what is inherently in their self-interest, so that transmutes into something that's more beneficial for them and the other, which co-creates exponentially.
Yeah.
In response to that, so I know enough about game theory to know that I shouldn't talk about it often. And so, but what I will say is this, that when you contemplate traditional games and you put the team structure in place, being a big Union fan and being a half-breed Maori, I can tell you that the matching of the indigenous energy of that deep earth nature of I'm going to rip your throat out, which is basically what the Hakka is, combined with the left-brain white man who's civilized and trying to be prim and proper, and you put those two together, and then you put a group of people on a field and say, we have one common goal. We have one common goal, and that's to win the damn game. Mm-hmm. And then you put that all together, it becomes a bit of a force, as most Aussies know. But what we're talking about is the game theory of humanity, where as you unify the purpose of humanity into evolution, now you've made the game, because you said that game theory says it's competition where one stands, and I'm just saying, and I'm not accusing
I'm
saying that when humanity gets into game theory and says, we're one consciousness ultimately, and then we're going to play the game as one, God, who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, like I think Have you read Richard Dawkins' Selfish Gene? Yeah. So it's a great book. So I think a lot of people misinterpret self-interest and selfishness, again, as a bug or as a bad thing, and that's not what it is. It's primal.
It's like saying that matter is flawed. Matter is just a lower dimension, and there's different levels of expression
it's
of complexity.
Though, right?
Yeah, it's a base emotion.
Out,
yes, it's
a
base
out,
part.
You don't have anything else.
Yeah, well, then you're going to run in front of a truck and die.
Correct.
Well, so we call it, we talk about it, and we call it the one in the oneness. So you're one, and there's this connectedness. Quantum physics say that it's all one. So there's this oneness, but you cannot argue with the fact that you have a consciousness within that structure right there that I don't have the ability to access your thoughts, your feelings, and all this stuff. And when you the evolutionary process of self-selection or seeking for the self, eventually what happens is as that consciousness evolves, it meets a place where it realizes if I continually seek only for myself, I actually limit myself. And that's the place where I think we're finally at as a humanity, where there's enough people waking up and saying, well, actually, it serves me to serve others. Now, if I overserve, if I give my one away, if I self-sacrifice,
that's not balanced.
It's not balanced, and that's not sustainable, because then if I give my life for you, then I got no more life. But if you and I both have an agreement that we're going to serve each other, then all of a sudden, and that's the Moore's Law that you were talking about.
It's Metcalfe's Law. The network effect. I mean, the value of a telecommunication system is based on the square of the participants.
Yep.
So inherently, mathematically, 4 competing against 4 is 16 versus 16, but 8 working together is 64, which will always beat. It exponentially shows. So, I mean, you got to understand the component and the individual on it, but then you understand the next dimension of societal organization, where we're a lot stronger together than we are apart. And there's certain levels of self-interest that correlate to my base emotions that show that working together is better. And, you know, as long as you find that balance, you can continue to elevate more and more. And that's part of the whole plethora of technology that comes in is, you know, you touched on a lot of pieces, which I like. You're thinking that way. And I've been saying that. You need social organizational technology. We need educational technology. We need distributed ledger technology. We need hardware technology. We need communication technology. And we need agricultural technology. We need alternative energy technology. There's a whole wave of new technologies that are going to be hitting the world. And I think distributed ledger is one piece of it.
Correct.
And I think it's also a genesis to demonstrating what happens when people come together on a global scale and what we can all really do. And from that, let's find out what happens.
Absolutely. Boys, thank you so much for the time. I think we could jump down a million other rabbit holes, but let's just save that for round 2.
Let's leave that there.
Yeah. And we definitely look forward to catching up again on a round 2.
Likewise, brother.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks,
guys. Thank you. Cheers.